Good morning. Welcome to the press briefing of the UN here in Geneva. Today is Friday, 24th of January. And we have to start this briefing with the alarming news that are coming from the Democratic Republic of the Congo. I'll start by reading the statement of the Secretary General that we have distributed to you yesterday night so that it goes on record. And then we will hear from OHCHR and UNHCR on this very dear situation. The Secretary General is alarmed by the resumption of hostilities in Eastern Democratic Republic of the Congo. He condemns in the strongest terms the renewed offensive launched by the 23rd March movement, the M23, since the beginning of the year, and its expansion into North Kivu and South Kivu, including the recent seizure of Sake, which increases the threat to the town of Goma. This offensive has a devastating toll on the civilian population and heightened the risk of a broader regional war. The Secretary General calls on the M23 to immediately cease its offensive, withdraw from all occupied areas, and abide by the 31st July 2024 ceasefire agreement. The Secretary General is deeply troubled by the most recent report of the group of experts established pursuant to the Security Council Resolution 1533 concerning the presence of Rwandan troops on Congolese soil and continued support to the M23. He calls on all actors to respect the sovereignty and territorial integrity of the Democratic Republic of the Congo and to put an end to all forms of support to armed groups, whether Congolese or foreign. The Secretary General reaffirms his unwavering support for the peace efforts led by President João Lourenço of Angola to de-escalate tensions between the DRC and Rwanda and commends him for the progress made so far. He urges the parties to remain engaged in the Luanda process and maintain momentum on the neutralization of the FDLR and withdrawal of Rwandan forces, as well as the swift operationalization of the reinforced ad hoc verification mechanism. The Secretary General urges all parties to uphold human rights and international humanitarian law, including by ensuring immediate and unfettered access to populations in need of humanitarian assistance and respecting the civilian character of internally displaced persons' sites. He reaffirms the determination of MONUSCO to implement its mandate to protect civilians and strongly condemns action by any party that endangers the safety and security of UN blue helmets and civilian personnel. So this is attributable to the Secretary General spokesman, Stéphane Dujarric. And on the humanitarian issues and human rights issues, we will hear more from our colleagues. Would you like to start? Whatever. Okay,
I can start.
You go ahead. Thanks,
Alessandra. Good morning, everyone. Good to see you here this morning. A quick update from UNHCR on the situation in the DRC. We are gravely concerned about the safety and the security of civilians and internally displaced people in the east of the DRC. The conflict is further intensifying across South and North Kivu provinces. The displacement figures have now surged to more than 400,000 people this year alone, which is almost double the number that was reported just last week. Since we last updated you last week, several IDP sites, internally displaced people sites, have been attacked. On the 20th of January, explosions were recorded at the Kitalaga site, which killed children, while on the 21st of January, five makeshift shelters were destroyed in Nuazolo. And yesterday, the Bushagara site was heavily impacted, and that caused panic and new waves of displacement. The violence escalated in South Kivu's Minova and Kalehe territories, displacing an additional 178,000 people as the intense clashes led to armed groups taking control of Minova and Kalungu. At least 80% of the civilians fled towards Goma, which, as you know, is a very important humanitarian and logistics hub for that region. Our colleagues are also monitoring the borders, and we are ready to respond if there is any movement of potential asylum seekers across the borders. Meanwhile, as we just heard from Alessandra, fighting intensified in North Kivu's town of Sake, which is approximately 25 kilometers away from the hub of Goma. And that culminated in armed groups seizing control of Sake. The bombardments from these clashes caused families to flee various displacement sites on the periphery of Goma and try to seek safety within the city. And our staff, UNHCR staff, remain on the ground in Goma, assisting the displaced civilians wherever they can and wherever they get access. But as you can understand, that access at the moment is extremely challenging. The persistent clashes continue to deteriorate the protection environment for the civilians in the provinces. And remember that these two provinces, North and South Kivu, are already host to 4.6 million internally displaced people. That was before the latest clashes. And the country as a whole hosts 6.7 million internally displaced people. This is one of the largest populations of internally displaced people anywhere in the world. And we've been here in front of you before reporting on various occasions in the last year, sadly in the last years, about human rights violations, including looting, injuries, murder, arbitrary arrests of displaced people, kidnappings, and so on. What we hear from our colleagues on the ground at the moment is that the hospitals in Goma and in the region are absolutely saturated, and the precarious conditions continue with a lack of access to food, water, and other services. We, of course, echo what the Secretary General has called for to uphold human rights and international humanitarian law, and we urge all parties to prioritize the protection of civilians and respect the civilian nature of these IDP sites, some of which have come under direct attack themselves. For too long, the civilians of the DRC have been battered, abused, and forgotten. It's high time that they were given a break.
Absolutely. Ravine.
Good morning, everyone, and thank you so much, Matt, for laying out a lot of the human rights issues so eloquently. We are deeply alarmed at the heightened risk of an attack by the M23 armed group on Goma, the capital of North Kivu in the Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo. The M23 recently took control of the city of Sake in neighboring South Kivu, following fighting with the DRC armed forces. Recent hostilities between the M23, the DRC army, and other armed groups in the village of Bweramena, about 50 kilometers from Goma, left at least 18 civilians dead. Some 400,000 people have been displaced in North and South Kivu since the beginning of this year alone. Any such attack on Goma risks catastrophic impacts on hundreds of thousands of civilians, putting them at heightened exposure to human rights violations and abuses. The High Commissioner is calling on all parties to the conflict to de-escalate tensions, and consistent with their obligations and responsibilities under international human rights and humanitarian law, to ensure that civilians are unharmed. They must also respect the principles of distinction, precaution, and proportionality, and ensure that those in need have safe and unfettered access to humanitarian aid. The High Commissioner appeals to all states with influence on the parties to impress on them the urgent need for an immediate cessation of hostilities. As the High Commissioner has said previously, any role played by Rwanda in supporting the M23 in North Kivu and by any other country supporting armed groups active in the DRC must end. The people in the DRC are exhausted by violence, exhausted by conflict, exhausted by the horrors of their daily life, and this must not be allowed to worsen further.
And I'll conclude this information on the situation in the DRC by also reminding that MONUSCO has reiterated several times and very recently that it's imperative that the group lay down, the M23 lay down its weapons and abides by the ceasefire in place since 4th of August. And also, as the Secretary General did, the peacekeeping mission urged all parties to remain committed to the Luanda process. And I'll open the floor to questions now on this matter. Robin?
Good morning. For those people who are newly displaced in the Eastern DRC, what are their options at this point in time?
Thanks for the question, Robin. I'm afraid the options are stark and they're extremely limited. You can go to a displacement setting, a displacement camp. When you go there, what you will receive in terms of aid is extremely limited. That depends very much on whether agencies like UNHCR and our partners in the UN and NGOs are able to access those sites. If they are, we can bring in a minimum of assistance. Otherwise, civilians will be in areas that are now occupied by the armed groups. We don't have access to those areas, so it's very difficult for us to say what conditions are like there. I think in general terms, we've said this to you many times here at the Palais, but the situation in the DRC is very much a forgotten crisis. It's underreported. We try to bring it to your attention, so thank you for coming here and for your interest in it. Our funding for the country, once again, is extremely low. We're currently at 10% funded for an appeal of $226 million for that country. So we do take this opportunity to appeal to the international community to support us and our partners for the essential work in very difficult conditions in the country right now.
Thank you very much. Yes, Jeremy?
To follow up on the previous question, it seems like all reporters on the ground are saying that some people are fleeing to Rwanda. So I'd like to know, do you have any figures? How many are actually leaving to Rwanda? Could be a kind of a paradox since M23 is supported by Rwanda at the same time. So how do you explain that those people are actually fleeing to that country? And the second question, maybe for you, Ravina, it's getting a bit political, I know, but are you welcoming the efforts made by Turkey to act as a mediator in the crisis?
Thanks for the question. Well, at the moment, we don't have any confirmation of people who have crossed into Rwanda or Uganda, which would be the other location from where you might expect people to move if they were going to seek asylum abroad. But we are monitoring that situation, and we will update you as soon as we have information. I mentioned earlier the figures for displacement within the country, but let's not also forget that the DRC is an important host itself of refugees and asylum seekers. Over 500,000 from Central African Republic, South Sudan, Burundi, and Rwanda, as well as there already being over 1 million refugees from the DRC in neighboring countries, and half of those are currently in Uganda. We'll update you a bit more on the cross-border situation when we have more information.
Jeremy, on the second question, first of all, we were speaking about funds. The appeal for 2025 for DRC is 15.1 million for the moment, 0% funds. Of course, we are at the beginning of the year, but it's an important appeal. And then for the peace process, as I said, there is a process, the Luanda process, which is engaged. And as I said, the Secretary General really urges all parties to commit and continue committing to it. Any other efforts toward peace in this troubled region is obviously welcome, but there is a process, and we really hope that everybody will remain engaged in that process. If there are no other questions, I'll go to the platform. Catherine.
Yes, good morning. Thank you to all of you for briefing on DRC. Alessandra, could you please repeat the figure of the appeal for 2025? I have also a request is to send us, please, the last report that has been written by the group of experts in which they are underlining the involvement of M23 and of nearby Rwanda in the situation of DRC. Could you kindly also send us as soon as possible your notes, particularly Matthew, because there's a lot of figures that you mentioned. I'd like to know, Ravina, if there is any specific decision or intention to do something from your office regarding the situation. I know that the president of Angola is the facilitator, but coming from UN, as the SG did make a very strong statement and a very important political statement today, is there going to be more coming from the UN? And Alessandra, I don't know if it would be possible maybe to organize a briefing with the UN Special Envoy for the Great Lakes region, Mr. Huang Xia, and also the Special Representative of the SG, Madame Bintou Keita, to know a little bit more about what's going on in the field. Because the, as Matthew said, the humanitarian situation is becoming more important through the decades, but I mean, we'd like to know a bit more from the UN. There are peacekeeping keepers over there. It would be nice of you. Thank you so much to the three of you.
Okay, I'll start, maybe, Catherine. Several things. Yes, for the group of experts, we'll send you the report, the link to the report. For the funding, as I said, it was 15.1 million. The information is, of course, on the OCHA page for the Democratic Republic of the Congo. We've got Ian here. I don't know if you have anything more on this. You asked about about the possibility of a briefing. We have been in contact with our colleagues yesterday night. It is possible that we managed to make to organize a briefing. In the meantime, I'd like to call your attention to a video that we have posted this morning. I'm trying to find here. It's a video where our colleagues of MONUSCO reacts to the latest violence in Eastern DRC. In particular, the spokesperson for MONUSCO, Ndeye Kadilo, says violence has reached alarming new levels following the M23 armored group seizure of Minova in South Kivu. And I really would like to invite you to have a look at this video. I can share with you the link. Matt, you'll send your notes. Yeah? I don't know if there's anything else you want to add.
No?
Okay. Ravina?
Thanks, Catherine. We are present in Goma. As you know, we have a human rights service that is present in many parts of the country. So we are continuing to monitor as closely as we can the situation of human rights violations, documenting reports and raising the alarm. And one issue that never gets sufficient attention really is the issue of sexual violence as well. The High Commissioner has flagged many times that sexual violence is a key component, a very horrific component of this conflict. Armed groups abduct, hold captive and subject women and girls to sexual slavery. Many of them have been killed after being raped, and the cases are most certainly underreported. So we do continue to try to monitor, document, and report on the situation.
Thank you very much. I see that Miladin has also posted the link to the statement from MONUSCO in the chat. I've just put the video link. I saw Lisa. Lisa, you have questions?
Yes, I do have questions. Thank you. To both of you, if you'd like to respond, is that you specifically, Ravina, appeal to countries of influence to use their influence to try to somehow mitigate this disaster? And you mentioned the role played by Rwanda specifically. Does Rwanda continue to deny that it has any role to play in this conflict, that it is indeed supporting the M23 with arms and so forth? Are you in discussion with Rwanda? What does it actually say right now? And Matt, I guess it is a kind of conundrum if Congolese do cross over the border to go into Rwanda. There seems to be some sort of conflict there. And then perhaps in a naive way or whatever, it appears that the government is terribly outgunned in some way by this rebel force. Does the government not send enough troops to the area in order to try to protect the civilians? And I mean, I don't think it wants to lose that territory either. Those are my questions specifically for that. And when you're through with this, I have a question on another topic, if I may, please. Thank you.
I see that Yuri also has other questions on other subjects. So let's stick to the DRC for the moment. Ravina.
Thanks, Lisa. This is a well-funded, quite a sophisticated armed group, the M23. And the High Commissioner has, you know, during his visit to the DRC, I believe in April last year, he had already called on Rwanda and all other states to cease their support of this armed group and to instead work together to bring this conflict to an end. You'll also see in the Secretary General's statement that he has cited the role played by Rwanda, citing also the Security Council resolution concerning the presence of Rwandan troops on Congolese soil and their continued support to the M23. On the Rwandan response to this, of course, I can't speak on their behalf, so I would encourage you to reach out to the authorities themselves. I think that covers it.
Sorry. I can maybe just add, you know, as I stressed earlier, we don't have confirmation of movements across the border, but of course, UNHCR and our partners do have a significant presence in both Rwanda and Uganda. So, should that need to be mobilized, we're ready to do so and work with our partners in those countries to support those countries.
Thank you. Gabriela.
Thank you, Alessandra. Good morning, Ravina. My question is on another subject. So
I see more questions on DRC. So wait a second, please. Catherine, you have a follow-up?
Yes, thank you, Alessandra, for giving me the floor back. Matthew, regarding movements across the border, in one of the last speeches of the president of DRC, he said that movements were monitored by UNSAT. And I think he repeated it also during his speech in Davos. So are you in contact with UNSAT? Are you guys working with UNSAT also for the movements across the borders?
Thanks for the question, Catherine. Let me get back to you on that. I don't have any specific details of how that monitoring is being coordinated, but we can get back to you later in the day on that.
Thank you very much. So is there any other question on DRC? Lisa, is that a follow-up on DRC?
No, it's on another subject.
Okay, as you said. Okay, so I don't see other question on DRC online or in the room. Just for housekeeping, we haven't finished with OHCHR because we've got Amin who has to brief you on the situation in the West Bank. So if the questions are not on Israel, maybe you can stay. Okay. Matt, thank you so much. Maybe in this case, I'll ask Tamin to come. We'll hear from him on Israel. Ravina stays on the podium and eventually can answer questions on other subjects. And then we will hear from Jens on Nigeria. Voila. Tamin.
Thank you, Alessandra. Good morning, everyone. We are deeply concerned by the use of unlawful lethal force in Jenin in the occupied West Bank. The deadly Israeli operations in recent days raise serious concerns about unnecessary or disproportionate use of force, including methods and means developed for war fighting in violation of international human rights law, norms and standards applicable to law enforcement operations. This includes multiple airstrikes and separately, apparently random shooting at unarmed residents attempting to flee or find safety. Israel, as the occupying power, has the responsibility to protect the population in the territory it occupies. As UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, Volker Türk, has stressed, Israel must adopt and enforce rules of engagement that are fully in line with applicable human rights norms and standards. Our office has verified that at least 12 Palestinians have been killed and 40 injured by Israeli security forces since Tuesday, most of them reportedly unarmed. Among the injured were a doctor and two nurses, according to the Palestinian Red Crescent. All killings in a law enforcement context must be thoroughly and independently investigated, and those responsible for unlawful killings must be held to account. By persistently failing over the years to hold accountable members of its security forces responsible for unlawful killings, Israel is not only violating its obligations under international law, but risks encouraging the recurrence of such killings. After weeks of violence by both Israeli and Palestinian security forces in Jenin, over 3,000 families have been reportedly displaced. Essential services such as water and electricity have been interrupted for weeks. The Israeli security forces have also shut down entrances to major Palestinian cities such as Hebron, closed checkpoints, and initiated long individual searches of vehicles at those that remained open. This has cut off thousands of Palestinians from neighboring communities and paralyzed daily activities. 13 new iron gates have reportedly been installed at entrances to other towns across the occupied West Bank. Following the Gaza ceasefire announcement last week, settlers have been attacking Palestinian villages and stoning vehicles, injuring several Palestinians. Houses and vehicles have been set on fire. We are also concerned by repeated comments from some Israeli officials about plans to expand settlements further still and a fresh breach of international law. We recall again that the transfer by Israel of its own civilian population into territories it occupies also amounts to a war crime. The High Commissioner calls on Israeli authorities to cease all settlement expansion and instead evacuate all settlements as soon as possible, as required by international law. We call for an immediate end to the violence in the West Bank. We also call on all parties, including third states with influence, to do everything in their power to ensure peace is achieved in the region. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And before taking questions, I would also like to refer you to the statement of the Secretary General in front of the Security Council on the 20th of January, where he expressed also his concerns about the situation in the West Bank that continues, as he said, to worsen. And he said, I'm deeply concerned about an existential threat to the integrity and continuity of the occupied Palestinian territory of Gaza and the West Bank. There's more in the statement. Okay, so let's start the questions. I'd like to have questions on this subject first, and then if you have other questions, we'll take them later on. Beiza.
Thank you, Alexandra, and thank you, Samin, for the briefing. I want to ask, you know, as we already had concerns about Israel possibly turning West Bank into Gaza as well, I want to ask how the Human Rights Office evaluate the timing of the Israeli attacks in Jenin and the lifting of the U.S. sanctions of the settlers. Could this decision have emboldened such settler activities and military actions in the West Bank? Thank you.
Thank you, Beza, for that question. Indeed, it is very concerning that what's happening today in the West Bank may have an impact on the ceasefire in Gaza. It is imperative that the ceasefire in Gaza holds. It is also imperative for Israel to cease all settlement activities and not to transfer its own population, civilian population, to territories it occupies. The presence of settlements in Palestinian occupied Palestinian territory is unlawful, and it should end. And we are calling on Israel to evacuate all the settlements in the West Bank. Thank you.
Go ahead.
Sorry, any word on the lifting of the US sanctions on the settlers, illegal settlers in the West Bank?
In fact, any decision that is made by any third state, we hope that any decision helps to put leverage towards a solution to the settlement problem and more globally to the occupation problem. The ICJ was very clear that the settlements should end, their presence should end, and the Israeli presence in occupied Palestinian territory should end as rapidly as possible.
Other questions in the room on this subject? Let me go to the platform. Gabriela.
Yes, Alessandra, but it's not on this issue.
Okay. Lisa?
I'm sorry that Matt has left. Maybe he's still in the room.
He
or
is.
If not. Okay, good. Question for both Matt and for you, Ravina, on the same subject, and this happens, concerns the Trump administration, which has cut off the possibility for people to claim asylum. I'd like to have your reaction to that. I'd like to know whether this violates the 1952 Refugee Convention. I also wonder, Matt, specifically for you, whether this U.S. policy also cuts off the possibility for third country resettlements, and whether you are in contact with the Trump administration about this situation. And Ravina, specifically for you on this subject, does the denial of people, that is, the inability of people to claim asylum, does this violate their human rights? Thank you.
Lisa, thank you very much. As I said, I wanted to first finish with Israel. There are many of your colleagues who also have questions for our colleagues on other subjects. So let me just see if there is any other hand up for Tamin on Israel. Thank you. So I don't see any hand in the room. The only one on the platform is Gabriela for the moment, who has another subject. So thank you very much, Tamin, for this update. And Yuri has a question for you, Gabriela, other people. But since Lisa has already asked, maybe I'll ask Matt to come back to the podium and keep Ravina here for the other questions. Do you want to start answering? And then I'll give the floor to Matt, who's arriving to the podium. Thank you.
Sure, Alessandra. Thank you, Lisa, for your question. Our position on this has been very clear. Let me start by saying that our office engages in dialogue with all states and their representatives, our office and the various human rights mechanisms. And we look forward to continuing this engagement with the authorities, with civil society interlocutors, with all others who have an interest in human rights and who have a role to play. That doesn't change depending on who's in office. On the specific issue of migration, as I said, our position is clear. All states are entitled to exercise their jurisdiction along their international borders. They need to do so in line with their human rights obligations. The right to seek asylum is a universally recognized human right, and we urge all states to ensure humane and human rights-based border governance, including ensuring migrants' rights to individualized assessments of their particular circumstances and protection from collective expulsion and from refoulement, as well as from arbitrary arrest and detention. As you know, we've called for all states to expand the availability and accessibility of pathways for safe and regular migration, including regularization mechanisms in line with international human rights standards. International norms that were developed by the states themselves constitute the best base on which to build state responses to multiple and complex challenges related to migration.
Thank you very much, Ravin. I will hear from Matt on this subject.
Thanks for the question. Yeah, I mean, in general terms, in relation to our relationship with the US government and the new administration, we would say that we've worked very closely with the United States for many decades now, and we remain committed to engaging actively and constructively with the US government to support refugees and those people who have been forced to flee. The US has for a long time been a global leader in refugee protection, demonstrating a strong tradition of offering safety and assistance to those fleeing war, violence, and persecution. And we hope that that long continues. More specifically, as regards Lisa's question around asylum and the potential border measures, we're currently studying the substance of the announced executive orders, so we're not in a position to comment in detail on them at this stage. But generally, what we would say is that UNHCR has, of course, always acknowledged the sovereign right of countries to manage their borders while upholding, importantly, their commitments to refugee protection. And of course, our position on asylum is well known, and we repeat it here most weeks that we come. Asylum seekers must, of course, have access to fair and efficient procedures to determine their claims. Individuals fleeing conflict, persecution, and violence need effective avenues for seeking safety. In addition, people in need of international protection must not be returned to a place where they face a risk of harm. There was also a specific question, Lisa, thanks for that, on resettlement of refugees to the United States. On that one, we are currently analyzing the announced executive order in relation to admissions, but we would reiterate that refugee resettlement is a crucial life-saving measure for those most at risk, including, importantly, survivors of violence or torture, women and children at risk, and individuals with legal or physical protection needs. We remain ready to continue our work with the new administration to find solutions for refugees in need of safety, including through this important avenue of resettlement.
Thank you. Lisa?
Just a quick follow-up, Matt. Does the United States and other countries, do they, let's see, how do I phrase it? That is, the United States is in the process, it says right now it's going to send back 500 undocumented workers or people, undocumented migrants. And so can the United States simply deport whoever it wants to a country, home country? What if the home country doesn't want to accept these undocumented workers? Does it have a choice, or does it have, or can the U.S. simply dump these people into, I don't know, Venezuela or El Salvador, what have you?
Thanks, Lisa. Well, I think that's a hypothetical question, and I won't go into detail there, but all I would say on this one is we would reiterate that there is agreed international law around refugee protection. There is also national laws in any countries that are involved. And of course, we would say those laws need to be respected.
Gabriela, I haven't forgotten you.
Thank you, Alessandra. Thank you very much. Matthew, do you have an idea of how many irregular migrants have been sent, deported to Mexico? I heard about 1,000 around, but Mr. Trump wants to deport something like that, like 10 million. And this is not a hypothetical question. This, he has been threatening of doing this since he was in campaign. So he began to do it. So are you going to help the people that is going to Mexico? Mexico, I mean, the government is overwhelmed right now with the people that are coming to the country. So how do you see the situation? And of course, Ravina, there's a in the United States, there's persecution trying to find undocumented migrants in the churches, in the schools. They are going to even to the houses. This is persecution. I mean, how can you describe this situation? Thank you.
Thanks for the question, Gabriela. It's right to say that Mexico has for a long time been a champion of refugee rights through a strong asylum system. And that will prove crucial in the months and years ahead, considering the extremely complex and volatile situation that the country faces in the region. If you look at 2023, which is the last year for which we have full data, Mexico received 130,000 asylum applications, which was an increase of almost one-third year on year. UNHCR, of course, has long supported the government, particularly the refugee agency COMAR in Mexico. With COMAR, we've helped 200,000 people, refugees and asylum seekers, primarily to rebuild their lives in Mexico in recent years. As you know, you've been following the news, the Mexican government has said that it is ready to respond to potential deportations from the US. It has a comprehensive plan for doing so, which includes setting up multiple temporary reception centers in the north of the country and potentially relocating the people of concern to different parts of the country. UNHCR is, of course, supporting and ready to further support the government of Mexico with our staff, with our field presence, including mobile teams, including for legal counseling if it's needed, and including for the identification of people who might have international protection needs or indeed displaced Mexicans. And let's not forget that there has been a certain amount of turmoil within the country, and there are people who are on the move in the country who feel it is unsafe for them to return to their homes at the moment. So in summary, we are there, we are supporting the Mexican government, and we're ready to keep doing that in the months ahead.
Thank you very much, Lavina.
Thanks, Gabriela. I mean, Matthew covered a lot of the concerns that you expressed. Migrants, and in particular undocumented migrants, are among the most vulnerable in any society in countries across the world, including the United States. And as I've said, it is crucial that any steps that are taken on border control, humane and human rights-based considerations are at the forefront of these measures.
Gabriela, you have a follow-up?
Yes, if you can comment on the situation of persecution of migrants in inside the USA. And also, I have a question on Mexico. There's a state, Sinaloa, that is a state where El Chapo Guzman used to live, and there's a lot of narcos there, Cartel Jalisco Nueva Generación, and the society, they are in their houses, they can't go out, children can't go out to the school, people are afraid of going to even to the hospital, and the government is the army. I mean, they are not doing really anything to protect the people. So my question to you is, if you are aware of this situation in states of Mexico like Sinaloa, people can't enjoy their human rights. I mean, they can't even go out to play, the kids. So are you in contact with the Mexican government? What are they going to do? Is this out of control? What are your thoughts on that? Thank you.
Thanks, Gabriella. What you're describing sounds just impossible to live in. We, as you know, we have an office in Mexico, and yes, we are in constant contact with the government on a whole range of issues and are closely monitoring all developments. I don't have notes from the office this morning on this situation, but we can follow up and get back to you this afternoon with something.
Gabriella, sorry, I've got quite a few other people who have asked for the floor, so let me give them a chance to speak. Yuri, you have been waiting patiently to ask questions, so please go ahead. Maybe he's gone in between. Let me check. Yuri, if you are there. Yeah, you're there. So just unmute yourself.
Yes, thanks. Thank you. But nobody proposed me to reactivate my mic. That was the problem. Thank you. Hello, Ravina. Hello, Alessandro. Hello, everybody. I have two questions. One is on the USA and one on Moldavia, Transnistria, to be more precise. The first question about the USA is the fact that we knew this morning that the Trump administration is going to delete the department that was in charge of the civilian casualties under the Ministry of under the Pentagon. They had the department that was monitoring the consequences for the civilians of the hits of drone strikes, etc., that the USA were striking everywhere, and they will delete this department. Are you concerned about that? And my second question is about Transnistria. There is in Moldavia, there is a problem with the gas. Maybe you heard about the situation from the 1st of January after the contract between Ukraine and Russia was not maintain on the transit of gas. This small territory in between Ukraine and Moldova is without gas, so that means that these people don't have hot water. They have only cold buildings because they can't do anything during the winter. Are you monitoring the situation, and are you calling to find quickly a solution between Moldova and Transnistria on gas? Thank you.
Thanks, Yuri. I'm afraid I don't have clear responses to either of those questions. On your first question, I mean, there are lots of developments this week in the U.S., so our colleagues are closely monitoring them, following them, and assessing the actual impact. And then, you know, we can speak on them once we have studied them properly. So on that, I won't be able to respond. On Moldova, yes, of course, we're aware of the situation. But again, perhaps this is not so much for the Human Rights Office. It may be a broader question to other parts of the UN. If I have anything specific from a human rights perspective, I can get back to you on that.
Thank you very much. Katrine.
Yes, this is a question on Syria. Is it the moment, Alexandra?
Yeah, go ahead. We are taking different subjects on.
Okay, thank you. Ravina, it's for you. It's regarding what's happening in Syria and how your office is monitoring the situation regarding human rights, and particularly the rights of women. We see a lot of videos and testimonies about how women have to be totally covered, are not allowed to go out in certain cities without a man. A father, a brother, a husband, and also about the background of the person that is now leading Syria. We know that his background is not really someone that is matching with the respect of human rights. So I'd like to know how you're monitoring all that, and Alessandra, what is the reaction and the position of United Nations? Because everybody reacted toward Bashar al-Assad. But I'd like to know what is going to be done regarding this person. I've read the different statements of the SG, but I'd like to know more, because things are going on and the heads are not looking at what's happening in Syria.
Thank you very much, Catherine. Yes. Ensuring women's rights is just not a matter of justice. It's essential for anything that concerns the development of a society, whether it's sustainable peace, economic development, social progress. Obviously, no society can really flourish without respecting and giving equal opportunity to half of its population. So the UN urges all parties in Syria to take immediate steps to honor their international obligations, to safeguard the rights and dignity of women, and to ensure that women have an equal voice in shaping their country's future. This includes the right to education, freedom of movement, political participation, and protection from violence and exploitation. If you want to add something, Lavina, on this.
Thanks, Catherine, for this important question. As you know, the High Commissioner was recently in Damascus, and he had the opportunity to engage at the highest level, as well as meeting with civil society actors. The picture is quite complex and quite nuanced as well, depending on where in the country you are. There were, in the meeting that the High Commissioner had with civil society, there were women present as well, which, of course, is extremely important. As Alessandra said, any path forward for the country needs to be an inclusive path. Women, of course, need to have a seat at the table. They need to have active and meaningful participation in the economic, public, and political spheres, in any formal negotiations as well for the way forward. That is the key to ensuring a successful transition, absolutely, without a doubt. On whether we've documented attacks against women, we are receiving a lot of reports from inside Syria. And yes, of course, we are continuing to monitor closely the situation in the country. It's very difficult to verify reports. However, we are continuing to collect them and to corroborate them. Our monitoring does indicate that women and men have been victims of numerous killings, abductions, and looting incidents. What's difficult to determine is whether women are being targeted because of their gender or for other reasons, whether these are just attacks of a criminal nature or otherwise. We are continuing to try to document and corroborate these reports.
Matt, you want to add something?
I could just add briefly, while we're on the subject of Syria, that our High Commissioner Filippo Grandi is in the region. He has been in Lebanon, where we issued a local press release. He is traveling to Damascus to meet the new administration, and he will be going on to Turkey, obviously, to discuss the question of the returns of Syrian refugees and how they can be best supported in Syria, through our offices, but also those of our partners in the United Nations and INGOs.
Thank you very much. Gabrielle, and then we will go to Jens.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Alessandra. My question is for you, Alessandra, and well, if someone wants to answer, and Christian, I think is WHO, he's there. My question is on Mr. Trump leaving the WHO. It's strange because, especially in this moment, there is an outbreak of bird flu there in the United States. So it's not a good moment to leave the organization. But if Christian has to say something, Alessandra, what do you think? Do you fear that Mr. Trump could leave another UN organization, or if he is going to give less money to the organization? If you heard something like that, yeah, that's my question.
Yeah, I think Christian is here. I think we have already expressed this question on the last briefing with Tariq. The issue of leaving the WHO, as Tariq explained, is a complex one. Maybe Christian can say a few words about that. But definitely, I think that the most important thing is to underline, and I'll let maybe Christian say it again, the will of WHO to continue cooperating with the United States and the health bodies in the country. Christian, I'll let you say something about that. I think you're more qualified than me. And also, on the part of your question where you say if we're worried, this is a question that has come to us several times these days. I would like not to speak about worries, but underline the fact that we continue the work here. As I've heard many of you saying, are you worried for International Geneva? Is it going to be a problem? I think we have to look at the problem in another way. First of all, we, as Matt said, don't comment on hypothetical things. I think WHO has said it. We are looking, they are looking into the decision of the new administration, which concerns them, and they are analyzing the possible consequences. But for what concerns the UN and the UN International Geneva, I think we can say that whatever happens, we have a country here and a city where we have more than 40 UN agencies, more than 400 NGOs, permanent representations of almost every country under the sun. So we continue working. Multilateralism is important today as it was yesterday, and even maybe more today. So we will continue working, and we look at this, and of course hoping and willing to work in good harmony with all the administration of our member states. Christian, you want to add something specifically on the WHO?
Yeah, thank you very much, Alessandra, and yeah, thanks, Gabriela. Maybe just a couple of words here. As we said it before, we regret the USA announcement, and we hope that the new administration will reconsider it. WHO is committed to engaging in constructive dialogue to preserve and strengthen the historic relationship between WHO and the USA. And let's, to your specific part, let's not forget, WHO works everywhere. As we just mentioned, we had colleagues, including Mike Ryan, traveling Afghanistan and Pakistan recently. We have colleagues working in the DRC and in Goma, for example, are involved in this. We are working on the Marburg outbreak in Tanzania, and we are working on many other fields, as you all know. WHO protects the US with a sophisticated health intelligence system that works to detect, characterize, and assess threats in real time. And the H5 outbreak is a particular example for that one. And we did have actually individual contacting us already about the concern that this might now be a problem as data are not coming forward anymore and may not be shared. But before we see this all happening, again, we need to analyze the outcome of, or the impact of this announcement, how this plays out in the future. But yes, it's a concern. It's a concern for global health, much more for global health than for WHO alone, because WHO provides critical information to the US as a WHO member state, one of 194 member states, on outbreaks and emerging health threats, but this is a vice versa thing. We also need the information, as you all know, from other outbreaks to respond and to have the best possible international response. Yeah, let's leave it at that.
Thank you very much, Mr. Liang.
Hi, thank you, Alexandra. Thank you, Christian. My question is also to Christian on the WHO. It's a follow-up question that I'm taking back from Davos. Earlier this week, I'm learning from Davos that the WHO in upcoming year is going to give more focus on climate issues related with health against the backdrop of US withdrawing and budget dwindling, just in the pursuit of higher impact for, maybe for less expenditure, but just for higher impact. Am I right in understanding that the climate issues related with the bearing on public health is going to be high on the WHO's agenda? And is that a little bit, still a little bit conceptual? Would you kindly elaborate on what specific projects you have on your mind, some pilot schemes, things like that? Thank you.
Yeah, thank you very much. So I do not have specifics of the climate health agenda or climate change and health agenda with me right now, but you are indeed right. Climate change and health is one of the top priorities of WHO. We have been going on very strongly about this particular topic. We all across the world have been feeling the effects of climate change and the advance of diseases and outbreaks. So it is a priority topic, and it will remain a priority topic. A possible impact of the US announcement cannot yet be seen and cannot be evaluated, but again, it remains a WHO priority.
Thank you very much, Lisa.
Hi, Christian. Good morning to you.
I'll let you go on. I'm sorry.
When the United States leaves, you will lose out on a lot of money. Are you already taking measures on how you will have to tighten your belt? That is, figuring out ways of, things that you may not want to do without, but that you can do without. Is this also something which is occurring right now to see where it is you can save money? And also, I would like to know whether the lack of money, who will lose out? What concerns you most, because you're not going to be able to deal with many of the so-called forgotten emergencies. We just had one, the DRC. If you could talk a bit about all that. Thank you.
Thank you. A bit of an overview here, Lisa. Thank you. Let me start with the last part. Who will lose out, or who will be left out? It's the people of the world who will lose out. It's global health that will lose out. It will have an impact. It would have an impact. Let's call it that way. The announcement, if carried through, would have an impact on the people's health across the globe, on public health. On the specifics, as you know, maybe the Director General yesterday addressed already staff in an announcement, and announcing the possible impact and the measures that we take already. I mean, let me first remind everybody that in terms of reforms, over the past 7 years, we have already implemented the largest set of reforms in WHO's history through the WHO transformation, which has made us more effective, more efficient, and results-oriented. And change is a constant, and we are committed to continuous improvement. But on possible reduction of funding, well, there are various ways. First, as I said, the DG yesterday already addressed a staff in an internal staff letter and highlighted a couple of impacts that might already have on the key priorities, which may need to be aligned with strategic alignment on human resources, on travel, on procurement and other purchasing, and an office support or supplies. So that's already announced, and it will have to be seen what the concrete measures have to be. Let's leave it at that.
Thank you very much. Gabriela, is that also for Christian? Because I wanted to let...
Yes, yes, Christian.
I wanted to let Ravina and Matt go, but Matt wanted to just, if you don't mind, Christian, let me finish with my colleagues on the podium. Matt, before you go, you wanted to give a short announcement?
Thanks very much, Alessandro. Yeah, I just wanted to bring to your attention that we are releasing a press release today which highlights the number of global emergencies that we responded to last year and the number that were declared. The total number that we responded to was 43 emergencies last year, and one-third of the new declarations, emergency declarations that we made, were linked to climate change and climate-related disasters. So have a look at the press release and the report. It goes into the different situations and how we respond to them through our global network. Thanks for that.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thanks, Ravina. Thanks to Matt. Everybody's asking for your notes, so whatever you can distribute. And I'd like to ask Jens to come to the podium while we are listening to the last question and answer from Gabriela. And also, I have to correct my... Jens. Yeah, he's coming on the podium. Ah, Christian, okay. I also have to correct myself for the appeal for DRC. You want to come here? Yes. So I'll do it in a moment. Let's listen to Gabriela and then also Agnes, who have got a question for you, Christian. Gabriela.
Thank you, Alessandra. So USA going dark at this moment with no data on bird flu or other outbreaks is extremely serious. But if there is a need of investigation, you have your team there. You can go there or contact scientific community inside the USA, even if they are not members, no? What is the procedure there? Thank you.
It's a bit complex, Gabriela. We do have, WHO has collaborating centers all around the world, and the CDC, the US CDC, famously being one of them. But we do not have WHO teams everywhere on the ground. For every being on the ground, it needs an agreement with the host country, so a country office needs to be approved and set up by the host country, meaning out of 194 member states, we have about 150 country offices. Famously, in most of the European cities or countries, and in the US and in Canada, for example, we do not have a country office. So through this network and other networks like the GISIS network, the Influenza Research Network, through IHR and others, we are in constant contact with member states about regular programs or about outbreaks and emergencies in case they arise, and about the notification process. But indeed, if that went silent from the US side, that would be an issue. That would really cause a problem, both for the US as much as for the citizens of the world. Because if vital data about any outbreak anywhere around the world is not shared, that has been hampering efforts, response efforts all the way along. We are, the world's population is relying on the fact that we share data amongst each other, with each other, to best respond to outbreaks, to emergencies, to disease developments, to virus developments. So this is essential and would be a huge disadvantage to not have one share of this information.
Agnes.
Hi, Christian. Just a follow-up on the letter that you mentioned earlier. Would it be possible to share that letter with the media here? And then, sorry if I missed that, I wanted to ask you if WHO has already tried to engage with some dialogue with the United States, and if yes, if you could specify at what level exactly, or if you have asked but haven't had any answer. Thank you.
On the staff letter, no, unfortunately not. I understand it has been leaked already, but it remains internal staff letter, and hence we cannot share it. Yes, we are in dialogue, or we try to be in dialogue with the US administration, because we will work to adapt to the situation. We will work to see if we need further communication, talk about the withdrawal, all the steps on the way, and to see if there's a way for us to reunite again in that sense and to reverse the announcement of the US administration that we deeply regret, as we said. I do not have specifics now who is talking at what level. We can see if we get details on that, but I'm not sure that's readily available.
Thank you. Lisa, this will be really the last one, because we have still one subject, and then eventually we come back to that. But very, very quickly, please.
Yeah, very, very quickly. Christian, can the United States stop funding WHO right away, or is it, I suppose it can do that, or does it have to wait for a year when it officially leaves your organization?
So the one-year deadline is something which was set by the US Congress when the US joined WHO. So this is not a WHO requirement, this is a US requirement. And it says something along the lines that the arrears have to be paid in full when they do so. Having said that, the 2024 payment, which was due in January 2024, so a year ago, has not been paid yet. That would have been a share of about 130 million, which is the assessed contributions half share, the assessed contribution for the biennium, and half of it due each year. So 130 were due last January, have not been paid yet, which is not unusual. And to date, we also have not received the 2025 assessment, the membership fee, so to say, which would have been due now. Voluntary contributions, of course, as the name says, are voluntary and hence, I believe, could be cut anytime.
Thank you very much, Christian. Thanks for all these details. So let me go to Jens. And first of all, apologize because I gave you a partial, not completely wrong, partial information about DRC. Jens, maybe you'll explain better, but I was referring to the amount that I mentioned was the need for the OCHA's office, and the humanitarian needs are much more important for DRC. We're speaking about 2.5 billion. For a population of 11 million people in need. So I apologize. We will put this in the notes so that it stays on record. But please note that we are speaking about 2.5 billion to help 11 million people. And I understand the funding is 0% at the moment.
That's correct, Ms. Sandra. So thank you very much for that. Little update. I have a short note on Nigeria. We have just launched the 2025 response plan, which again focuses on the troubled northeastern states of Borno, Adamawa, and Yobe, where conflict, climate shocks, and economic instability are exacting a heavy toll on civilians. This year, we and our partners aim to reach a total of 3.6 million people in the northeast, with health services, food, water sanitation and hygiene, nutrition for children, protection, emergency education, and other vital support. The appeal asks for 910 million in funding for this year. As global funding has been declining, the Nigeria plan aims at further enhancing the efficiency in aid delivery to make scarce resources go further. And that means reducing transaction costs by funding more directly those delivering assistance locally and shifting to cash and voucher assistance where possible. It also includes acting ahead of events such as floods and disease outbreaks to mitigate their impact, what we call anticipatory action. Another element is working more closely with development partners and the government to reduce vulnerability and therefore the risk of future humanitarian needs. So I have sent you this brief note. There's also a press release, and there's a link to an overview of the appeal for further detail on that. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Jens. Any question on Nigeria in the room or online? I don't see any. So thank you very much. Again, we will correct in writing the amounts for DRC. So I have only three announcements for you. The first one is about the commemoration of the International Day in memory of the victims of the Holocaust. As you know, this is a day which is commemorated on every year on 27th of January, the day of the liberation of the Auschwitz camp. The camp was liberated in 1945, so this year we commemorate the 80th anniversary from that date. And we will, as usual, mark the day with a a solemn commemoration at the Palais under the theme of this year's commemoration, which is Holocaust Remembrance for Dignity and Human Rights. So you are all convened on Monday, 27th of January at 1 p.m. in room 18. In addition to the statements from the Director General and the permanent representatives of Israel and head of permanent delegation of the European Union, we will also listen to the family experience of loss and survival of Mr. Ivan Lefkowitz, who is a Holocaust survivor of Bergen-Belsen concentration camp. So you are all invited to join us for this important event. You remember that we told you that the Secretary General was going to hold this beginning of the year press conference in New York, but we had to postpone the event because of his travels. Now the press conference is announced for the 30th of January at 4:30 Geneva time. And you will be able, of course, to follow this on Web TV. And then my last announcement is about the Committee on the Rights of the Child, which will conclude this afternoon the review of the report of Ecuador. And that's the last one, the last country that they had on their agenda for the review of this session. And this is what I wanted to mention. Is there any question? Any further question? No? So thank you very much. Bon appétit. And I'll see you on Friday. Thank you.